Integrating the environmental and genetic architectures of aging and mortality.
Does telemedicine change low-value care use?
Can we manage gestational diabetes with a provided diet to women who are pregnant?
And is there evidence that vitamin D can actually prevent acute respiratory infections?
That's what we're talking about this week on Double T Health Watch, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a Baltimore-based medical journalist.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I'm going to take this ball and run with it. We're going to turn right to Nature Medicine, this thing that I actually read the title, Environmental Architecture and the Genetic Architecture, and what do they have to do with aging and mortality? These investigators were looking to quantify the relative contributions of environment, which they refer to as the exposome, and genetics to both aging and premature mortality. First, they looked at an exposome-wide analysis of all-cause mortality, including about 500,000 participants. And then they assessed the association of these exposures with a proteomic age clock that they already had in place in 45,000 plus of the folks who are in the UK Biobank study. And they were able to identify 25 independent exposures that were associated with mortality and proteomic aging. They compared this genetic component versus the exposome component to 22 major diseases and said, okay, the polygenic risk score explained less than 2 percentage points of additional mortality variation, while the exposome explained an additional 17 points. Now, I have to point to all this amazing amount of diagrams that they've used here. In fact, these contributions to mortality that are part of the exposome are the same old things that we know about already. Environment, education, do you have any money or not? Are you renting your home? As a proxy, how many cars do you have? A little bit about ethnicity, an assessment of mental health and how that might be engaged. And finally, at the very end of the paper, they have this pretty cool bar graph that looks at these relative contributions. And they point at things like breast cancer, prostate cancer, and ovarian cancer as things where the genome, the polygenic risk score, has a whole lot more to do with whether you develop this or not, against age and sex, and then this exposure, this exposome, and how that impacts on the development. I think it's a very interesting way of looking at the data, and there's some great graphs, and I'm not sure we know anything new as a result of it.
Some people say, well, it's in the genes and, you know, it's just genetically determined. And others would say, no, it's your environment. Well, the truth of the matter is it's both. And there are certain diseases more influenced by one than the other. And that's what I think this paper contributed. Things like dementia, macular degeneration, those were found to be predominantly influenced by the genes. Other things that are prevalent, cerebrovascular disease, ischemic heart disease, COPD, rheumatoid arthritis, and liver and kidney disease, they're more likely to be influenced by the exposome. And there are a couple things in there that I had not thought about. Obesity before the age of 10, mother smoking during your infancy, sleep, whether you have a partner or not. I thought it was fascinating because it quantitated and it's dependent upon which disease you're looking at.
Interestingly, with regard to the exposome being the predominant factor, they identify chronic liver diseases, COPD, lung cancer, same old things, I would say. It's just a different way of looking at the data. If you smoke, your likelihood is high that you're going to get lung cancer. If you have substance use disorder and you have a lot of alcohol consumption, it's high likelihood that you're going to develop chronic liver disease. Clearly, those are things that we're exposed to. I do think it points out that there are things that we can do to modify our risk, and we're always happy to see that.
Yeah, and there were some things I found surprising. For example, Asian or Black ethnicities, a lower risk of having mortality.
Right, and I think that brings up another really excellent point, which is that while this UK Biobank is revealing a lot of really interesting stuff, it's a very small snapshot of the population. And even the authors admit that their Asian and African-American population is really pretty low in comparison to everybody else. So how representative is it really? And I don't think we know the answer to that.
Well, since we're talking about disease, let's talk about something in Lancet, and that is there evidence that vitamin D supplementation can prevent acute respiratory infections? Any infection of the respiratory tract with symptoms up to 21 days. This study was initiated because a while back there was a systemic review. The data were mixed. Some suggested that vitamin D could prevent respiratory infection, others did not. So this systemic review, there was a likelihood that vitamin D could reduce your risk by about 8%. There are six new randomized controlled trials that have come out since that. So they added those trials to the previous ones to say, is it any clearer? And the answer is, nah, it's really not any clearer. In fact, it's a little bit muddier. They found the same thing, a very modest benefit, if any, approximately a 6% lower risk. But now it didn't reach statistical significance. There were some subsets that suggested that it could be helpful. Individuals between the ages of 1 and 15. Under the age of 1 and over 15, it didn't seem to help. It didn't seem to help if you were taking a high or low dose. You kind of had to take a medium dose of it. And it didn't seem to be beneficial if you took it over a year. These are all what's called post-hoc analysis. I guess what I'd say is if you're taking vitamin D to lower your risk of respiratory infections, probably not very beneficial.
This just reminds me, Rick, in our decades of recording, that we seem to have these dietary strategies that were purported to be the be all and end all. And then, when subjected to rigorous scrutiny, sometimes even turned out to be detrimental versus beneficial. And I'll point to vitamin E in that regard and lung cancer. My question about vitamin D is if you have adequate sun exposure, and here in this country, of course, we have vitamin D supplementation of dairy products, isn't it probable that your vitamin D level is more than adequate?
In fact, our vitamin D levels in general are better than many other populations around the world. But they analyzed this particular study and said, well, maybe it could be beneficial in those that have a low vitamin D because the studies measured it. And in fact, it didn't.
Okay, turning back then to nature medicine, this look at, gosh, if you give women pre-packaged meals when they have gestational diabetes, can you impact on outcomes relative to their pregnancy? We know that gestational diabetes, of course, is a big problem and becoming more of a problem as more women are overweight or obese when they get pregnant. So these folks decided to do a multi-center parallel randomized controlled double-blind trial of energy restriction in women who were pregnant with single fetuses. They already had gestational diabetes and their BMI was greater than or equal to 25 kilograms per meter squared. They were randomized to receive a standard energy control diet of about 2,000 calories per day or a reduced energy intervention diet, about 1,200 calories per day, from their enrollment at 29 weeks until delivery. And this was provided as weekly diet boxes. Their primary outcomes were maternal weight change from enrollment to 36 weeks and offspring birth weight. However, there were some outcomes that I would opine are maybe a little bit more important than that particular outcome. They had 200 plus women in each arm of their study, and they were able to get outcome data for 90% of their participants at 36 weeks. Their interesting and sort of like soft pan conclusion is there's no evidence of a difference in maternal weight change between these two groups. And then they say a reduced energy diet was safe in pregnancy. Meanwhile, they were able to impact in a very positive way on the women's hemoglobin A1C levels, on the weight gain of the fetus. What do you think?
The endpoints are kind of soft. The risk factors for gestational diabetes are being overweight and obese and excessive weight gain in pregnancies. It was safe. I'm not terribly surprised. Here's the one group where it seemed to be beneficial, Elizabeth. Overall, many mothers did not lose weight, but there was a small group that did, and those were the women that seemed to benefit.
Yeah, and that weight loss improved the time that women were in a good range as far as their glucose levels in their blood. Their systolic blood pressure was also significantly reduced. It did reduce the rates of large for gestational age infants in that group.
And by the way, we're not talking about a lot. We're talking about 3% of their weight. We're talking about 3 kilograms. That's about 6 or 7 pounds. Those women and their babies seem to have a beneficial effect.
To me, this seems like a strategy that's well worth adopting for the very many women who have gestational diabetes.
Yeah. And it begs the point, well, maybe a 1200 calorie restriction may not be enough. And as we're not just trying to restrict calories, we're actually trying to get them to lose weight. And that should be the target.
And let's just add that the women found those who were on the 1200 kilocalories a day, that that diet was perfectly acceptable.
So it's doable.
So let's turn to the last one then.
Does telemedicine reduce low-value care use? The American Board of Internal Medicine published something called Choosing Wisely. We want to make sure we do appropriate tests to make the diagnosis for prevention and screening, but low-value care are those medical tests and other services that really offer very minimal benefit, and actually they have the potential for creating patient harm. It can lead to excessive medical spending, and it can actually divert your attention from tests that otherwise are helpful. So what happened during COVID? We converted a lot to telemedicine. Okay, with telemedicine, do you reduce the use of low-value care because they're not seeing the doctor as often? Or conversely, do you do more of this testing because you don't get to see the patient and you're unsure of how to treat them? That's exactly what these investigators tried to assess. They looked at the 20 different things that I mentioned that the American Board of Internal Medicine decided were low-value care. They looked at different health systems, had about 1 million people that had low use of telemedicine, and they had about 1.4 million that had high use of telemedicine, and they compared them. The use of telemedicine resulted in an increased number of visits, but there was reduced use of the low-value care. Of the 20 tests, 7 of them were used less frequently. The overall cost was lower, even though they saw the physician more, and the estimate is that that would have saved $66 million by using telemedicine.
Let's mention that this is in JAMA Internal Medicine. I think that this is especially timely in light of the fact that many states are rescinding a lot of their telemedicine capability right now.
To me, that's a real disservice both to the patient and to the healthcare systems. Elizabeth, as you know, El Paso and our sister medical center in Lubbock, we serve 100 plus rural counties. 30 of those have no healthcare provider at all. And it's not uncommon for the people to have to drive 2 or 3 or 4 hours to receive care in one direction. Well, we can provide healthcare via telemedicine and to remote rural hospitals to provide the consultation they need to take care of individuals. Doing away with telemedicine is not going to lower healthcare costs and leaves many people stranded in rural areas.
In light of the fact that there are so many rural hospitals that are closing, this is exacerbating that. I think I just saw a study this week, in fact, that pointed out that the average amount of time that someone spends getting to a healthcare provider if they live in a rural area is some 3 times longer than what someone in an urban area experiences.
Yeah. And so for routine care for a working person in rural America, taking off for 2 or 3 or 4 hours to go see the doctor is really untenable. If they need an acute service, it's really a problem. Here's a great study that shows that, yeah, you saw the physician a little bit more frequently, but we didn't order as many tests, and there was an overall savings as well. So there is value to it.
On that note, then, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up. Make healthy choices.